The students have different backgrounds, and so they pick themselves the topic that they wanted to explore this year. And it's interesting to see that the first two groups focus more perhaps on the cultural landscapes in Montreal. But and the challenge, if you want to go back even further back in time, would be to have historical documents or information about what was the landscape like, the natural landscape like. And obviously, this will be done also through inferring from ecological knowledge, from what was the physical environment, from the type of potential vegetation that it can support. So the next couple of groups will address these issues. This group has focused on the geology and the hydrology of Montreal, trying to sort of recreate or find information, baseline information for us to know more about the hydrology and the geology, because of course it's going to determine also land uses and land cover. So.
Good morning. I'm Marley, and I'm part of the physical baseline group along with Tracy and Laura. And our group's goals were that we wanted to create a base map of the physical land features of Montreal. So we split this up into the geology and the hydrology. Tracy explored the bedrock and surficial deposits. As for the hydrology, within such a short span of the course, we determined that using a scale of Montreal would be really unrealistic to accomplish. So we focused on hydrological features that have disappeared from the island, specifically the St. Martin River and Otter Lake between Lara and I, respectively. Through studying the Manahatta Project, we realized that having a base map was really essential for the Hochelaga project to grow over time. The hydrology and the geology are very interrelated, and their interactions ultimately determine the flora, the fauna, the communities that are developed, and then the human settlements, which each in turn affect the other factors. So now I'm going to hand it over to Tracy to talk about the geology.
Hello. So we decided to explain the geology of Montreal by describing the different layers. So first we have the bedrock geology and then the surficial deposits overlay on top of that. The map we used for the bedrock geology was one by Golbensky in 1985 because it is the most recent and precise representation of the bedrock geology of Montreal and the surrounding area. There is no electronic version of this map that we were able to georeference, so only Montreal was digitized for the bedrock geology as it pertains to our project. The rock types found on the map range from oldest to youngest as you move up the legend, which is consistent with the original map I worked from. Besides the Cretaceous igneous intrusions at the top, the rest of the rocks found on Montreal are sedimentary and come from the Cambrian and Ordovician periods. The oldest rocks are from the pre-Cambrian period, but they are mostly visible to the west of the island of Montreal in Oak and Vaudreuil. Sorry. Next, we have the Cambrian rocks, mostly made of sandstone and conglomerates, and the Covey Hill and Cairnside, the first two down there, make up that part. Then the Ordovician period, which is the rest of them except for the Montereagin intrusion, show the transitions right from dolomite to limestone to shale, which I have a table that shows the periods and what the different ones were. And finally, we have the igneous intrusions from the Cretaceous period, which are plumes of hot molten rock that cut through the weaker terrestrial crust, forming the Montereagin intrusions, the Montereagin hills, one of which is Mount Royal. The map we use to represent the surficial deposits of Montreal is the one by Prest and Hodekeiser in 1977. There were other maps that represented the surficial deposits as well. However, they didn't really give us any more information than this one did. And there you have a picture of that one here, too. Again, the deposits range from the oldest to the youngest. You can't see it as well here because this is a really big map, but that's the one there, English and French. sorry. Those deposits that go from oldest to youngest, it means that it's the deposits earlier to the most recent. This map has been georeferenced, but still needs to be digitized. So with the time constraints of our class, it's not really possible for us to have done, but possible future students can do that. This map represents deposits from the Wisconian Age glacial episode. So the first episode was the Malone glacial episode, where the ice advanced southward up the St. Lawrence Valley. The deposits from this ice are not well seen on the map that you saw before, because it is the oldest of the two glacial episodes. As the Malone ice retreated and melted, glacial lakes were formed and tilt was deposited. We call this the Middle Till Complex because it is the sediments that were deposited in between the two glacial episodes. The Middle Till Complex deposits can be divided into two phases. So you have the upland phase, which is made of silt, sand, and gravel, and the lowland phase, which is massive silts and finer sands, so smaller grain sizes. The Fort Covington glacial episode that came after that only events partway down the Lake Champlain Basin, and the glacial lake deposits from that retreat of the ice are also poorly represented on the map, only because the glacial lakes drain to sea level rather quickly. The weight of the ice on the land surface from the two glacial episodes caused the surface to be lower than the sea level, so water was allowed to pool in, and that formed the Champlain Sea, which is a good example of how geology is really linked to hydrology intimately. The Champlain marine sediments can be also divided into nearshore and offshore sediments representing the deep and the shallow parts of the basin. The nearshore sediments were eroded by wave action and so are gravel to sand sized, whereas the offshore sediments were not subjected to as much erosion and were deposited into quieter waters, so they're more silt to clay sized sediments. Then the St. Lawrence lowlands began to uplift, which raised the surface slowly towards sea level. This uplifting cut off the Champlain Sea from the east and formed marine terraces and beaches, which form the former shoreline, which actually, if you go down towards the old port, you can actually see that. As the surface continued to rise, the Champlain Sea reduced, causing brackish and estuarian conditions. This marked the beginning of the St. Lawrence River. River erosion then started to increase again, causing a cycle between erosion and deposition along the riverbed. Eventually, the transport and deposition of organic material occurred like peat, which is developed from decomposing plant material like moss, formed the peat and the bog episode at the bottom. So the surficial deposits seen on the map before the press map all have different characteristics in different areas, regardless of what category they're on this map, because of the difference in the grain sizes, the proportions of them, the compaction in whether the deposits are wet or dry. So this allows for different soil types to arise in different classes, from which environments can then be associated with those different soil types, and as well as the land use. So I have a table that actually shows that too. Is it not showing me? Okay. Sorry, here we go. So you have the different kinds, and then you have different land uses and certain remarks that can be seen from there too. There have been soil surveys done for Montreal, and data for those were obtained by me from the McGill Library Services. However, they're very detailed, and I just made a quick map here just to show you that this is just one section, and all those little polygons have different classes associated with them. So it would take an entire semester's worth of students to digitize the whole thing. So we suggest for future students to attempt this, that it be done by the entire group section by section, and this is just the attribute table that comes with it, and again, it's only one small section of that. And now I will turn that over to Lara.
So attacking this physical baseline project, part of Oshawaga, we couldn't ignore the fact that geology and hydrology are intrinsically linked. So we had different sources to approach the hydrology part. We decided to build on what has been done last year and follow also Sanderson's pattern as he did in Manhattan. So we decided to focus on one river and one lake, so the St. Martin River and the Otter Lake. So just to mention about the fluvial deposits, so we can see there are some post-Champlain sand and gravel deposits, which are characteristic of streams, so rivers. They're usually fluvial clays that will be softer than marine clays. Sometimes it'll be really hard to distinguish fluvial clays from marine clays, but they're still, usually they'll be characterized as being less compact, more silty, and more fertile. So this is also information that can be used and transferred to so many other parts of the Hochelaga project. It's also this element, this sediment deposit element, is also something that Montrealers have had to deal with, since fluvial clays are usually not satisfactory for building purposes, and it's still something we encounter today into Montreal's construction. So I'm going to present you, present you, the St. Martin River. So some sources claim that it had its source on the Mount Royal, was passing all the way through Le Plateau to reach Parc La Fontaine, and then head south and then west along Montreal's old fortifications. So as the group has presented before, here is the Marin map from 1687 to 1923, where we clearly see, and as it is marked pretty early on, it was called already the St. Martin River, and we can see it flowing right over here on this snapshot. So also on this snapshot, and sources mentioned that European settlers installed the first Montreal, when they came, they were installed between the St. Martin River and the St. Lawrence River. So this is usually an information that we got not through maps, but also through written sources. So, of course, at that time, the population of Montreal was concentrated on that small portion of the island, because when we think of it, this is only a small part, and it's a part that cartographers would focus on. So this is the Bouchette map that has been georeferenced by the previous group, and where you can see the St. Martin part of the St. Martin River that has been digitized. And the path of the St. Martin River here has been confirmed by other maps, where the St. Martin River flows right, separating the concentrated center, first center of Montreal, through then farmlands more up north. But then again, at first we would think, that's it, that's St. Martin River. But looking through written sources, and as I mentioned before, I don't see the sources of the Montreal and passing through Parc La Fontaine, so I figured there must be something more of it. So here is a map called Les Ruisseaux et Fossés, published by Montreal's Water and Sanitation Department, that actually, where there are a lot of streams, and a map that was also uncovered by last year's group of hydrology. And here would be, of course, I wouldn't claim the perfect accuracy, but following this map and the written sources of the path, so following the Mont Royal, passing through Parc La Fontaine, and the different branches, we discovered that the St. Martin River is way more complicated than what we could have thought at first. And there are also a lot of, St. Martin River was also changed throughout. So at some point, the population, So at the beginning of about the 17th century, some tanneries started concentrating around the St. Pierre River and the St. Martin River. And through time, the St. Martin River became very polluted. And it is in 1832 that Montreal experienced a cholera outburst. And so the St. Martin River had been ditched, straightened, before this outburst, but it was still very polluted, and at that date, something had to be done about that stream, and it was converted through sewers. So the river was put underground by parts, so gradually. So by 1845, so if we see maps after 1845, Here is just a snapshot of the Adams map that was presented by the development group before. The San Martin River after 1845 has completely disappeared. And so written sources again tell us that it has been put underground, converted in the Craig Street sewer. So, and also it was interesting to see that, to go back to the relation with the sediments, that while actually building the sewers and while renovating the sewers, well, they encountered some difficulty through the construction, and it is some difficulties that the Craig Street, also San Martin River, that used to flow along what is today Saint-Antoine Street in the old part, and it is a street that is still known today to have, well, encountered some construction trouble due to those soft sediment deposits. So I'll leave it to Marley for the Otter Lake.
So last year's hydrology group focused on the St. Pierre River. And the St. Pierre River flows directly through Otter Lake. And for this reason, Otter Lake is often referred to on older maps as Lac St. Pierre. And so my project for Otter Lake was similar to what Lara did with the St. Martin River. And so using old maps and historical records, as well as like current accounts of what happened in the past, we recreated a timeline and a rough estimate of where the lake would be today in modern Montreal. So roughly 8,000 years ago, the Champlain Sea was retreating, and it left a larger lake that covered the area from roughly Kingston to Quebec. And as this lake retreated, it left smaller lakes, such as Otter Lake. And skipping forward to the 16th century, the lake shores were cultivated by the natives. And as the Europeans came and settled, it became important for transportation, as the lake allowed for the rapids in the St. Lawrence River to be avoided. Looking for old maps of Otter Lake was difficult. As you can see, Otter Lake, which is here, is fairly far west and compared to where the main city center was. So because of this, there was really very few well-scaled and accurate and precise maps. Furthermore, the lake disappeared by the mid-19th century, so it stopped being recorded on maps, really limiting our resources in that respect. Ultimately, we chose to use two maps. The first is this map from 1776, made by Thomas Jeffries, and he was a very well-respected cartographer at the time, as well as a different portion of the Bouchette map that you've seen earlier. The maps, though they're excellent for the time, are fairly inaccurate, and so this, and fairly, like, not very precise, I guess. And so in terms of trying to create a spatially explicit model, this became very difficult. In the end, we came up with this representation here. You can see where Otter Lake would be at the bottom, roughly where the Lachine Canal is. If you look closer, you can see that from both of the two maps that I used, very different lakes were created. The difference in size could have been due to a number of things. The first is that the map scales may have been different for the lakes. Additionally, because the georeferencing wasn't particularly accurate due to a lack of control points, it could have distorted the maps. And lastly, a possibility is that in the time from 1776 to 1815, it's possible that the lake may have shrunk in size. However, looking at the map, the larger lake, which is from the Jeffrey map, it's fairly consistent with the textual references that I found of the lake. It's roughly 1 kilometer at its widest and 7 kilometers long, and extended from the west end of Côte Saint-Paul towards Rue Atwater. It also is fairly consistent with the press map. If you see the purple region right there, that represents the peat and bog The area was known to have a lot of troubles and was often referred to as being a very shallow lake or a wetland. In the early 19th century, or mid to early 19th century, the Lachine Canal was built. And in building the Lachine Canal, the ground taken from the canal was put into Otter Lake, and it led to the lake's eventual disappearance. Then the Grand Trunk Railway built onto this site, and it was the site of the Turcotte Yards. The area had a lot of issues with flooding, and in one particularly interesting anecdote, two locomotives were actually lost at the site because of the completely unstable ground. Finally, in time for Expo 67, the land had solidified, and we have what is now the Turcotte Interchange, which has troubles of its own. So looking to the future, Otter Lake is still an important presence, still has an important presence with the reconstruction of the Turcotte Interchange, as well as some of my research actually came from an archaeological survey done for the Glen site for the McGill Hospital, which was done because of the natives who had settled and cultivated the shores. For the future of the Hochelaga project, it's important that they clearly look at some of the accuracy and maybe explore other resources to determine if greater accuracy can be accomplished, and as well as looking at other hydrological features on the island.
In conclusion, geology, as we have seen, is intimately linked to many of the other topics, especially hydrology. Flora and fauna can be inferred from that as well as construction of buildings. So it was very important for our Hochelaga project that we determine this geological baseline upon which future projects can build. There's much left to do, but we look forward to seeing the final project. Thank you.
I'm going to take questions. I think we have a geologist there.
For the question, just raise your hand and I will go see you at the microphone.
Okay.
Hello.
Did you think about the effects of the bedrock in terms of the whole development of Montreal? So in terms of the sandstones, contribution to construction aspects in the history, and
sorry.
Just one other aspect. Yep. You talked about the hydrology, but you didn't talk about groundwater and groundwater reservoirs, and I wondered if you actually came across anything related to that.
Very little on groundwater, only because I'm not really a hydrologist, so I didn't really go much into that part. As for the bedrock, I'm sorry, what was the first part? It was... Building. Oh, yeah, sorry, hi. Yes, the documents that came with the maps that I was showing came in great depth on what the different sediments did, all the different sandstone and conglomerates, and what all of that did, except that if I were to have talked about all the different ones, it would have been, like, much longer than it already was. So I didn't go more in depth on that, but it went through all the different construction purposes, and I think it said that the for the first surficial deposit one, so the one in the bottom part, what was the Malone till, I think? It was just as strong as a bedrock would be, just as resistant. So that was more, like, good for construction and stuff. But, no, I didn't go more in-depth on it just for presentation purposes because it would have been too long.
I would suggest that you, for future people to look at, is the influences of the bedrock in terms of contribution to building materials?
It's definitely going into our actual written project, which is still in the process of the making. Just for presentation purposes, we just didn't want to go into all the different 10 pages worth of stuff. So,
Marley, you wanted to add something?
Oh, yeah. Just with respect to the hydrology, as I mentioned earlier in the presentation, we really just wanted to keep the scale of what we looked at very small, and so I'm sure it's out there probably, but for the amount of time we had allocated for the project, we just each focused on specific features of the island.
Okay. This is a total ungeology lake question, but in one map, there's this, you were saying, in the bottom probably red dress, there's the St. Martin's River, and then all of a sudden you see something else and it has all these little windy things going off and everywhere. And I was just imagining, okay, so they build this big sewer or whatever and they contain supposedly the St. Martin's River, and I'm thinking, is there always all these other little things running under the city, and is that contributing to the instability that we often get when they start to dig down there and try to fix things?
So, of course, I asked myself the same question. So one day, the part of the map, we have maps that show the transition of the part of the St. River, the St. Martin River, that's particularly documented. So next to the city center where you see first it's been ditched, and then the different bridges over the river that were built, and then finally by 1845 put totally underground. And then what happens to all those, and in some maps you could actually see some maps that I wanted to use but were totally under-referenceable. You see that they, for example, for the ditching, they only ditched a part of the river that was passing through the center, and then you can you see all those little branches. Well, not all of them, because the map I showed was, I guess, the more extensive one. But those other parts of the river that weren't ditched and weren't converted into sewers right away, that's for sure. But I know that the site under Montreal, that's concentrate on the sewers of Montreal, well, shows this map and mentions that the streams that are showed on the map follows most of the sewers that exist right now. Of course, not all of them. And also, I know that on the Mont Royal, we can still see sometimes some little streams, some little ruisseaux, and people, well, extrapolate and have a lot of hypothesis of the St. Martin River still being there on some parts of Montreal, actually, over the ground. So I wouldn't be able to claim it with, but I think that in some parts the St. Martin River is still here, and they haven't, they for sure haven't worked on it at the time of the whole super area, for sure.
I came a little late, but the tail end of the presentations I did attend, very interesting ones. The water resources which were there on the river, on the island, were not only negative, they played very positive role too. Most of the mills were also were built on high points and low points. High points were little windy spots where windmills could be built. You can see one in Lachine even today, and there are a number of those points. And low points which were there, you did mention tanneries, but all the mills were built along these resources too. And then it is the later on. So there is making of this whole island. They played positive as well as the sewer role.
I think that for sure all those rivers played also a really positive impact, especially when we see the maps of the 17th century, when we see the concentration of Montreal right between the St. Lawrence and the St. Martin River, and then all those farmlands that definitely benefited from all those streams, and that couldn't have been as for sure productive without the extensive streams that were there for sure.
Other questions? Yes? I think it's Janine, but I can't.
Thank you. Great presentation, you guys. That was really terrific. You've probably come across it already, but have you seen the Lost Rivers app for the iPhone or the... Yeah, so for those of you in the audience that don't know, there's this great app for your iPhone where you can go in and take a look at where one kind of reconstruction of where rivers are. And when I first put it on my phone, I was delighted to see that there's an old lost river apparently that goes through my backyard. So, which is, I have no idea about the accuracy of it, but I was looking at it when you were presenting the location of the Otter River, or the Otter Lake, rather, and they depicted in a slightly, I mean, same general area, but slightly different position. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how do you reconcile all the different maps that are out there? And
I also, in my research, I did use the Lost Rivers a significant amount. And so I found that some of what they said was in conflict with other things that I found. For example, the size, I don't know if it says specifically on that, from that source, that the size is 1 by 4 kilometers, but I've definitely seen that as well, as opposed to 1 by 7. And my, I guess, what I'm working with right now is the fact that this, at the time, while it was still in existence, there really wasn't a lot of development and wasn't a lot of very accurate, I guess, records of that lake itself. I mean, I'm sure it was in some ways recorded a lot, and some of it is very accurate. But I think the best way to deal with this is to collect a broad and wide range of sources for future, like using journals. I think journals would be an excellent resource because it can use other things in the area to provide reference points that aren't available from maps. And so I guess, yeah, that's how I would deal with that situation.
Can you overlay it at all with your soils or your geology? I mean, are those layers high enough resolution to help?
I think that overlaying it with the geology is something that could definitely be done in the future. I mean, the maps themselves aren't accurate, so no matter what, you're going to have some problems with the fact that there really aren't the control points, but it's definitely something that can be done to give some idea of how the landscape should look.
Certainly to look for consistency among the different sources of information. Other questions?
Just adding something with the fact that you were saying I have a river passing through my backyard, and I think that's something that was really gratifying about that project as well, digitizing and putting this ArcGIS digitize experiment into Google Earth and seeing where it was passing and through which building and through which streets, and like, for example, the stream passing all the way through McTavish, and that can't be a coincidence, we were saying. So that's really interesting.
Thank you very much. Thank you.